You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're finally nearing the end of 2020 and reflecting on the wounds that cut deep. We're gathering reflections from remarkable people in the literary world, the books they're reading, what they learned through COVID. What a tremendous privilege to spend the hour with author Leslie Jamison. I've been thinking about how she proudly wears the label Wound Dweller in her essay collection called The Empathy Exams, and her final essay concludes, "Pain that gets performed is still pain." Did the pain of this year spill over into words for you? Do you write or read as a means for survival? And if so, what was it like to express yourself or read other works in the pandemic era? It's 800-642-1234. Author and essayist Leslie Jamison is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. She teaches in Columbia University's MFA program. Her most recent book is the essay collection called Make It Scream, Make It Burn. Leslie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's so wonderful to be here, Kate. It's great to talk to you this morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, I have this huge appetite to ask you and all the authors we encounter here, how do you process and deal with COVID in your writing? Because, you know, in your answer, with whatever direction you take it, there may be some trick, some advice, some morsel of truth that we can take away here in our life in Wisconsin that is better than waiting for your next beautiful essay or your next like riveting book. What flows out of you in these times?
Yeah, I mean, I identify so strongly with the hunger for slivers of wisdom or ways of getting through, and have to be honest that so much of this year, like so many people, I have felt like, you know, month by month, as things keep changing and keep shifting and keep evolving, I too am just trying to figure out how to survive rather than having like figured it out and being able to offer that wisdom. And I've also felt, you know, so aware of the ways in which I've been lucky in health and family during the pandemic. I mean, I think in the beginning, so I've spent the entire pandemic in Brooklyn where I live. And, you know, so I think there was such an intensity to the experience here back in March when everything shut down very quickly. The hospitals were flooded. Everybody was getting sick. The streets were full of sirens. I did get sick very early on. And though physically I was extraordinarily lucky and it wasn't a serious case, I was, you know, living alone. I have a daughter who's a toddler. So there was an intensity to my early experience, you know, total quarantine, not leaving the apartment for 2.5 weeks, you know, being sick, taking care of my daughter. It sort of felt like we plunged right into it and could do nothing but just try to figure out, okay, we just have to make it through this week. We just have to make it through this week. And the first thing that I, you know, so that wasn't a time where I was like reading and writing my way through. It was more like a time where I was like making peanut butter sandwiches as a way to get through, you know, it was sort of survival was happening
like,
on that level.
I mean, but you have a toddler, like how much reading can get done, right?
Well, that's actually one of the things that I want to talk about with you, because some of the reading, we'll get to this later, but some of the reading that has, that meant the most to me, especially in the spring, was reading other people's writing about the pandemic or the quarantine, like the quarantine diaries and the pandemic journals that places like the New York Review of Books and the Point magazine and the Yale Review and, you know, a bunch of places were putting out this wonderful kind of diaristic writing about this current moment that we were all living through. And part of why I loved that was because it felt like, okay, we're all going through this collective experience in very different ways, but at the same time. But it was also, to your point, I loved reading them because I could read a 3-paragraph diary entry much more readily than, like, you know, a Tolstoy novel or something like that, because I was also taking care of a very little person. So I found that I was very drawn to artifacts of beauty that were sort of contained and discreet as well.
the bits and pieces, if you will.
exactly. And there's something that feels really honest to me too about the diary as a way of making sense of experience in real time. You know, so for example, the New York Review of Books started to do this thing very early on where every day they would publish one of these short diary pieces. And there was something about the urgency and immediacy and visceral. You know, I can still remember they published a beautiful piece by a doctor in San Antonio who was talking about, you know, hearing voices in the corridors of the hospital. And there was something about those particular details where she hadn't pretended to have figured it all out. You know, we were still inside of it. We had no idea what was coming next. Well, we had no idea what was coming the next week. But I felt really consoled by the company of other people's voices, simply being in that state of unknowing rather than prematurely resolving it.
Yeah, getting down the present, just recording and responding to the moment. And I think we all learned that just being present in the moment is all we could basically handle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things that I found really both jarring and moving about quarantine, especially early on, was the fact that we were, on the one hand, we were all inside this massive global event. It was a pandemic. It was devastating. It wasn't like, it isn't like anything that we have lived through in our lifetimes, but it was also, it was simultaneously happening on this global scale, but contracting at least most of our lives to something very small and very domestic. So the way we were actually living through it was like ordinary moments, kind of that Groundhog Day effect of waking up day after day. In my case, it's like waking up day after day in a two-bedroom apartment and, you know, doing breakfast oatmeal, like making a tea party for the stuffed animals, like, you know, putting the stickers on the farm background and then putting the stickers on the chipmunk house, you know. But it really not just invited me to slow down and be present in those moments, but actually really demanded it.
Yeah, I'm going to reintroduce you. We're talking with novelist and essayist Leslie Jameson about writing, about isolation, about illness, about making it in these COVID times. And you can share your experiences, 800-642-1234. You wrote such a powerful essay about the world before COVID and about how in early March, before everything shut down, you had went to a public sauna, including one in your neighborhood. Could you read a bit from that about the last time you visited the Russian and Turkish baths in the East Village?
Yeah. So I would be thrilled to read a little bit from it, and should just say, you know, for a few years, these baths in the East Village right near where I live have been this really sort of beautiful healing space. And one of the things that I have loved about them is that in a way they take so much of what I love about the experience of living in a city, that you're constantly glimpsing the lives of strangers and in these moments of communion with strangers, whether it's the, you know, I don't want to be like, you know, sort of sugarcoating it. Like sometimes it's the uncomfortable communion of the morning commute on the subway. You know, it's not always like an ecstatic moment of transcendence, but just, I came to realize in quarantine and in isolation how much I missed just spending time close to strangers. And I was thinking a lot about the Russian baths because it was almost this intensified experience of closeness with strangers.
Well, I want to just pause here before you read it here. So we don't, I'm going to just pause for a break as we talk with Leslie Jameson. She's the author of the memoir, The Recovering, two essay collections and a novel. And she teaches in the nonfiction writing program at Columbia. Has writing or reading become a sacred practice for you in these times? How have you handled the isolation or the lack of hugs, human touch? What have you learned about yourself and put into words? Join in at 800-642-1234. We will be back in a minute and hear the excerpt from Leslie Jameson here on the Ideas Network. How do we care for each other? How can we hold each other's pain in the pandemic? We're exploring these questions, lessons learned this year, with the help from the literary world here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and what a pleasure to have author and essayist Leslie Jamison in our Wisconsin orbit this hour. We're exploring her pandemic era insights, where she finds light and wisdom, and we're going to hear her words in just a moment. You can join in 800-642-1234. And Leslie, you're going to take us now into some of your words as you wrote about these baths and these public baths, and then you know, help us take us there.
So I did find myself during quarantine thinking quite frequently of this experience that happened right before the pandemic really struck here in New York, my kind of last night that I spent in these public baths in the East Village. And so this is a small piece of an essay that I wrote sort of reflecting on what the baths and communal spaces have to teach us about how much our lives are enriched by the strangers that we live among. So I'm remembering back to an evening in early March. That winter evening, I was a year into my separation, poised at the cusp of divorce, at the cusp of pandemic, at the cusp of my city's shuttering. But that night, my body was close to the bodies of these strangers whose stories I would never know. We didn't need to speak. We were sharing the heat and the darkness, tucked away from the chill. We were sharing our very bodies, sweating and exhaling into the same thick air we were all breathing. A few weeks later, once the virus filled our hospital wards and the city plunged into quarantine, everything about that night would come to seem not only impossible but unthinkable. That closeness and casual touch, all that mingled breath and sweat. That night would eventually seem like the distillation of what we lost. But back then, it still belonged to us, our bodies shrugging and sighing, our toes curled and our foreheads beaded, our bodies leaking tears of ache and release. We were part of something together, something big and silent and many-headed. It held us all.
Oh, that is just so beautiful. Thank you for sharing and reading that to us. I would imagine that as the crisis and disaster unfolded and you kept having flashbacks to that and the heat and the breath and people in a sauna, it must have been a lot of emotions coming over you.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, there's nobody living through this time who hasn't been sort of ambushed by memories of the before times. And, you know, I feel like so many people in my life are using expressions like that, the before times or before all this, you know, where, and what part of what's crazy is that it's the things that were most ordinary that at least for me, that I took for granted the most, just, you know, making small talk with, you know, stranger on the street, or, you know, just being in my apartment with beloved friends, like those small acts of sort of physical intimacy. And in that moment, I was thinking about, you know, even just to be in a room where everybody is breathing together is the kind of thing that it makes you feel a little bit of anxiety even to think about it, because we've been training ourselves necessarily and rightly to observe practices of social distancing and mask wearing and all the things we need to do to protect each other's bodies. But, you know, it's like, I was talking to a close friend last night and she was saying that every time, you know, she's watching The Queen's Gambit, and when she sees just scenes of people all walking around without masks on, she gets really anxious, you know, and I completely identify with that feeling of simultaneously longing for these ordinary scenes of bodily intimacy from the past and feeling how far away they are.
Yeah. And like even a type of jealousy as well, or yearning for. I want to ask you about smell, and which is so deeply connected to memory and emotion. And you quote Helen Keller, who called smell the fallen angel of the five senses because we don't appreciate it. What did you see there in that?
Yeah. So the way that I figured out that what I had was COVID, because I really had it so early that I not all the symptoms were known, and my particular case sort of felt like a case of the flu, except that I did have this total loss of taste and smell that, you know, we came to understand as actually one of the most useful distinguishing symptoms of COVID. But at the time, I didn't know what to make of it. It actually didn't feel like having a cold. I wasn't congested. I just couldn't taste or smell anything. And so, you know, for much of those, actually for kind of all of the 2 to 3 weeks that I spent just in an apartment with my daughter, I also couldn't taste or smell anything. And that came to feel like this kind of total quarantine. Like, not only was I not going out into the world, not only was I not seeing other human beings, but I actually couldn't even interact with the world, even the world of my own home, in this basic sensory level. And so it felt like kind of this profound isolation that actually made me appreciate more fully a smell that I think I and maybe many people take for granted, which is smell. It's not, you know, smell isn't delivering like the grand vista of Notre Dame or something like that. Like, it's not, it doesn't have the grandeur of vision, or, you know, there's not the symphonies that we associate with hearing, you know, it's like, but it's so integral to our memories, so integral to our experience of intimacy. And I, later on in the summer and fall, I ended up writing a reported piece for Vogue magazine, where I got to talk to a ton of smell scientists to really figure out why is smell so important to us. And so that was an instance where I was able to take, you know, a small kernel of my own personal experience and one aspect of my own experience of the pandemic and really turn it into a bunch of questions that I was able to explore, which was a nice way to take something I'd lived and turn it into a way of learning about the world.
Yeah. And, you know, smell offers us such practical things like, is something burning on the stove? Or, you know, does my kid's diaper need to be changed or not?
And I realized that, you know, it wasn't just good smells that I missed when I couldn't smell things. Like, I didn't just miss the smell of apple cider on the stove or hot cocoa or cantaloupe. Like, I missed the smell of my daughter's diaper. Like, I missed the smell of Windex. Like, I missed smells that I had never thought of as wonderful things, but I missed them because they were the stuff of life, you know,
fragments of a normal life. If you're just joining us, we're talking with novelist and essayist Leslie Jameson about writing, about isolation, about illness in these pandemic times, how she's processing these times through what she writes, through what she reads. You can join into the conversation, 800-642-1234. Leslie, I'm so eager to get to what in the world is on your nightstand. What are you reading or consuming these days? And I know you brought us a list, but I just want you to dive into it with a first book recommendation.
Yeah. So one thing to say, which I imagine many people can identify with, is that my nightstand not only has a towering pile of books, but it never feels like I make that much progress with the books because, you know, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, it's like, you know, I work full time, I have a toddler, I'm a single parent, there aren't a ton of hours in the day. And I really know this is true for so many people. You know, it's like, it feels like there aren't enough hours in the day to do all the things to survive, much less read a novel. But that said, you know, I'm lucky enough that a lot of my work, I'm a teacher, a lot of my work involves engaging with the written word. So I get to do a lot of reading as part of my job and also talk to my students about what we're reading together, which I find really helps me find even more meaning in it. But one of the books that I return to this year, and it's just a book that I have that I love deeply, and it's really connected to some of the ideas we've been discussing of finding meaning in ordinary moments and daily life, is a book called August 9th, Fog, by a writer named Catherine Scanlon. And the backstory of the book is really interesting, which is that Catherine Scanlon found a diary at an estate sale in Illinois that was a diary that a farmer's wife had kept and for years, and it recorded just lots of aspects of her daily experience, her daughter coming to visit for the day, baking an apple pie, her husband getting ill and she started to care for him, the changes in the seasons. And Catherine Scanlon had this impulse that there was so much truth in this diary, but what she decided to do was sort of whittle it away into this beautiful prose poem. So she just takes a few notes of truth or detail from each day and has created this small, beautiful volume that's really just a tribute to, you know, how much meaning is living even in those moments that we think of as the most ordinary moments of our lives.
Novelist and essayist, we're talking with Leslie Jamison, giving us insights on the world of books and how to lose yourself in a book in these quarantine times. She's also reflecting on her work as a writer. What would you like to ask the author? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we are just so lucky to be able to talk with essayist and novelist Leslie Jamison this hour. Her latest essay collection is called Make It Scream, Make It Burn, and we're talking with her about writing, about reading, and she owns it. She calls her nightstand a disaster zone, a perpetually toppling tower of a mix of books to read. I'm sure it's still getting taller. You can join in. What moves you most in a work of literature, especially reading in these pandemic times? What was the most fascinating thing you took away from a book recently? What do you want to discuss with an author? Join in. Line for you, 800-642-1234. And author Leslie Jamison is our guide for the hour. I want to move on to another book that you recommended, The Island or The Inland Sea by Madeline Watts, which is a climate change novel.
Yes. So Madeline Watts is a young Australian author, and The Inland Sea is her debut novel, and it's coming out. It's already come out in Australia and England, so it's available. I'm sure people can order it, and it's coming out in the US early next year. And one of the things that I was so struck by and moved by, Madeline was actually a student of mine at Columbia, and it's been a real pleasure to sort of watch her mind and her incredible voice developing over the years. But one of the things that I was so struck by in this novel is the way that it's about a young woman who's sort of figuring out certain like self-destructive patterns in romance, things that I think we can probably all identify with in Sydney. But she's also thinking about her own personal life and personal turmoil against the backdrop of the deep history of Australia's relationship to the climate. And in the course of the novel, a set of horrible wildfires are also devastating the land around her.
And so
but in a visceral way, it was like, really, she wrote this novel before the truly terrible Australian wildfires that we were all reading about on the news just a little while back. And so in a sense, it felt prescient, the way she had imagined that kind of devastation in this book. But in a way, it was the prescience of just knowing that, you know, we've set in play so many things as a human race that we're now watching the devastating effects of, and not, I don't mean that in a fatalistic way, like there's nothing to be done, but I both felt the ways in which there was a kind of almost like prophecy in her book, but also that she was addressing what I think is true for all of us, which is how do we inhabit the scale of our own personal, emotional lives as we're simultaneously contending with all of these huge, terrifying things happening all around us. Climate change, the global pandemic, the kinds of domestic and political crisis that we've been living through, that we all simultaneously have to do that scale shifting of the world feels like it's falling apart. I also have to take care of my kid, you know,
the practical and the, I mean, there's only so much you can just take on in a day. Mm-hmm. You know, in the case of Madeline Watts, I know you work a lot with these emerging, budding writers and helping them connect with their writing and where they want to go with it. What do you tell them in order to find their voice?
Yeah, so some of the things that I like to talk to my students about are both honoring the specificity of their own experience, so that the way to access some sort of truth is to just get deep into, you know, if there are lots of ways of writing, you don't have to write about your own life, but if you are bringing your personal experience to the page, to not be afraid to go deep with it, to go into the dark, messy, emotionally complicated stuff, and also to go into the physical specificity of, like, what did it feel like? What did it taste like? What did it smell like, to our earlier conversation? Because I think sometimes my students are afraid, like, why does my life matter? Or why would anybody care about this experience? And I think anybody's experience can be meaningful. I think everybody's life matters. I think it's just your job as a writer to go deep enough into the grain of life that you can find what matters inside of it. So that kind of go deep or get specific, those are things my students hear from me all the time. And I actually...
You brought a cape, right? You
I did. I was just going to mention that because, you know, my students would tease me sometimes because I say these phrases over and over again. I'm like, I know you guys get sick of hearing them. But I eventually made a cake for my students one semester that said, get specific on top, to acknowledge that I knew that I repeated it to them all the time.
Maybe it's getting through, but, you know, it is hard to, I mean, you want to be specific, but then you're thinking, well, you know, I should hold back. No one wants to know this. And you have to get over your own issues with that as well. But I'm wondering, even in these COVID times where you can be specific in your own journaling, in your own moments where you're trying to get down details, because oftentimes that is what journaling is about the everyday and those details.
Absolutely. And I asked my students back in March when the pandemic was starting to start keeping pandemic journals of their own, because I said, like, look, you know, we don't know what we're inside of, but write it down. Like, that's our job as writers, is just to try to write it down. And we actually, back in the spring, we had a reading over Zoom where all of my students chose brief excerpts from the pandemic diaries that they had been keeping. And we read them aloud to each other. It was one of the first Zoom readings that I was a part of. And it was magical in that sense of, you know, even as we were inside this state of missing each other and missing the world, we could create these weird new forms of community that we hadn't known before. And that one in particular, I was still in New York. A lot of my students were still in New York. And the reading spanned the 7 p.m. hour, which for much of the spring was the time when everybody in New York would, you know, bang on pots and pans and call out in the street to honor healthcare workers and other essential workers. And so there was when the reading hit 7 p.m., we all unmuted and we could hear the sounds of cheering for the healthcare workers kind of flooding our Zoom screens from all across the city. And it was this beautiful testimony to one of these elements of our new daily rituals that we just couldn't have anticipated a year before, but was that kind of ordinary moment that held something luminous inside of it.
I'm going to just reintroduce you. We're talking with novelist and essayist Leslie Jamison about writing, about illness, about this pandemic era, and how she's processing these times through books she reads, through writing, through working with her students. You can join in at any point, 800-642-1234. Leslie, you brought, you know, a good amount of poetry. And there's also a book-length poem, Don't Let Me Be Lonely. What did you see here?
So Don't Let Me Be Lonely is a book-length poem by Claudia Rankine. And it's about a lot of things. It's about violence, political violence, social violence. It's also about the interior psychic trauma of depression and various kinds of grief and loss. It has, throughout the prose in the book, there are small images of television screens. Sometimes they hold static and sometimes they hold, you know, photographs or images from the news. And in a very different way to The Inland Sea by Madeline Watts, the novel we were talking about earlier, Don't Let Me Be Lonely finds a way to document the fact that we are all living inside of our personal emotional experiences and broader social and political landscapes at once. And those little TV screens are one way that it does that documenting, I think, where it says, you know, we are feeling things in relation to our own lives, but we're also feeling things in relation to the news. She talks about reading about acts of police brutality against Abner Louima and feeling it as a pain in her gut, the narrator of those poems. And that to me, I think, spoke to something that I was really feeling quite strongly this year around the murder of George Floyd and the kind of epidemic of systemic racism, racially based violence that we've been living inside of for our nation's entire history, but get sort of crystallized in these particular acts of violence that we just can't turn away from. But that feeling of feeling it in the mind, in the heart, but also really in the gut.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I hear your little one in the background. It's so special. That's so great. I love it. What does poetry do for you? Because you write long form and, you know, you write in so many different forms, memoir and, you know, journalistic pieces and essays. But what does poetry do for you?
I think poetry and another collection that I was really responding to this year and spending a lot of time with was a collection by Denez Smith called Don't Call Us Dead, which is a collection that finds ways of documenting grief and joy at once. The first poem in that collection is called Summer Somewhere. And in that poem, Denez Smith is imagining an afterlife for Black boys in which, you know, they can, there's a devastating line in the poem where the narrator imagines just, this is a place where a boy can go out to buy candy at a bodega and come back alive. That something as ordinary as that would come to feel like fantasy in a certain, in the world that we live in.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that I love about poetry, to your question, that I feel like Denez Smith's collection does so well is finds ways of honoring the multiplicity of feelings that we're inside of at any given time, that that life holds grief and joy and love and despair at the same time. You know, like nobody goes through the world feeling only one thing, but it can be kind of mind-boggling to just hold all of the different emotions that, you know, a given day even contains. And I think the pandemic for me has asked me to really figure out ways of living in that simultaneity, how to feel love for my daughter and despair about the world at once.
We are in a tour of emotions, right, in the pandemic with our literary guide, the novelist and essayist, Leslie Jamison. How have you channeled your emotions, your illness in the pandemic? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with essayist and novelist Leslie Jamison. We've been leaning into the literary world, asking authors to make sense of these times. And it's such a privilege to discuss the emotions of the 2020 roller coaster ride with Leslie Jamison, the isolation, the illness, the words that flow from a prolific writer in this pandemic era. Leslie, I want to move to a major theme in your writing that comes out is empathy. And you imagine yourself, you know, into the lives of other people, people who are like you, people who are extremely different from you. Can you talk about how your understanding of empathy has changed over time and maybe what will emerge with your empathy after the pandemic?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I have a response, and I actually, if it's okay with you, I wanted to just read a brief paragraph from not my
please
own
do.
Work, but,
please do.
Something that meant something a lot to me that I read this year. But one of the things that has that I've always wrestled with when it comes to empathy is that one part of empathy certainly has to do with trying to bridge the gap between somebody else's experience and your understanding of that experience, trying to ask questions and learn about the experiences of others, trying to imagine or speculate about the experiences of others, that's part of empathy. But another part of empathy, it's always seemed to me, has to do more with minding the gap, with understanding, I can't know everything about your experience. I can't imagine everything about your experience. Like to kind of honor the ways that we live different lives rather than presuming I know what you feel or I know what this is like for you. And I think the pandemic has only intensified that tension in my mind. On the one hand, we are all living through a global pandemic. We're all living in relation to the same virus, but we're all living in relation to it in very different ways. And, you know, financial precarity, losing a job or having a job, not having healthcare or having healthcare, being incarcerated or not being incarcerated. Like these are major differences in people's lives that structure not only the different effects that the virus has on each of our existences, but also how much we can kind of imagine what it's like for somebody else to be contending with this same pandemic that we're contending with. So I've really been drawn to trying to seek out voices about what the experience of the pandemic has been like from people who are living through it in a very different way than I have been living through it. And I wanted to just read a brief excerpt from a pandemic diary kept by a man named Michael Murphy, who's incarcerated in Washington State. And it was published in a magazine called The Point that ran a series called Quarantine Journals that was, you know, a series of, as we've been talking about, these kind of beautiful dispatches from all kinds of people sort of writing from in the midst of an experience rather than the other side of it. And Michael Murphy wrote a beautiful quarantine journal called In the Petri Dish. And I just wanted to read the first paragraph of it because I found it moving and it was a reminder of the ways in which this pandemic is playing out in different lives in very different ways. So this is a piece of writing from April 2nd from Monroe, Washington. In prison, anything resembling fear must be rejected because fear is weakness and weakness is unacceptable. So here at the Monroe Correctional Complex in Washington State, talk about coronavirus has been mostly dismissive, and the sound of coughing has become a precursor to jokes rather than panic. The cells are spaced a foot apart and by far the smallest in the state, with bars rather than doors and hardly enough room for one person to move around, despite the fact that two are often crammed into them. We hear every sneeze, every yawn. Sometimes I even hear a neighbor a few houses down scratching a pencil over a pad of paper. And that last detail of somebody else, scratching a pencil over a pad of paper is not only a reminder of the power of getting specific and how that can bring us into other people's lives, but just a reminder for me when I read that, that some of the very same things that have been so difficult for me over the past 9 months, difficult for many of us, isolating in our homes, are also a privilege that isn't afforded to everyone, that kind of isolation, that people's bodies are understood as more expendable. Their vulnerability isn't honored or respected in the same way. And this personal voice is such a stirring and important reminder of that.
It makes me think, too, of when you, the journalist, have in the past, you know, interviewed an inmate, interviewed a prisoner, and what you take away from those experiences and trying to put words to their life.
Absolutely. I wrote an essay years ago that sort of sticks with me very powerfully to this day about a man named Charlie Engel, who was and is a very accomplished ultramarathoner. He does these extremely long distance runs. He's run across the Sahara. Like we're talking about really intense feats. And he was incarcerated on counts of mortgage fraud that were related to the subprime real estate crisis. And, you know, I think he would think that in a way he was sort of scapegoated for much much larger corporate crimes. But anyway, I was interested in his experience of incarceration because he was a man whose life was devoted to motion. He ran
Yeah.
everywhere. It was so important to him to sort of to have that freedom. And that freedom of motion is one of many things that incarceration takes away. And so I was interested in what it was like for a man whose life was defined by motion to have to stay still. And, you know, I was just struck by, in a way, the many things that we take for granted that incarceration, or that many of us can take for granted that incarceration takes away. I'm actually working right now on a piece of writing about an extraordinary art exhibit that's up at MoMA PS1 in Long Island City here in New York. It's an exhibit called Marking Time that's devoted largely to artwork by incarcerated artists. And it's a really kind of incredible testimony to the kinds of creative possibility that emerge from conditions of constraint. So beautiful sculptures made from the foil on cigarette wrappers and dental putty taken from the prison dentist and the cardboard backs of notebooks, you know, that these very ordinary materials are turned into extraordinary things.
Yeah, it just reminds me of visiting the Louisiana State Penitentiary and going to the Angola Rodeo, where around the rodeo are these grounds where prisoners have made so many different works of art or crafts or things with their hands, and that just what emerges, you know, from you know, a high security prison. You know, we're running out of time, Leslie, and I want to just ask you, there has been so much loss, so many lives lost. How do we deal with this grief? How do we deal with it through words when we've lost people?
Yeah, I think, I guess one of the things So the two things I would say, the first would be, you know, that often sort of seeing what language lives inside of you can not necessarily heal everything. Sometimes grief isn't, it's not about healing it. It's just about carrying it with you. But kind of the sometimes just writing down, again, as we've been talking about, the particulars of your own experience, the particulars of what you remember about somebody that you loved who you've lost, the particulars of what grief feels like, what the cold, sharp winter sunlight feels like when you're sort of aware of a beautiful blue sky and also aware of the devastating grief you're carrying into that beautiful blue sky. Like, sometimes it's helpful to just put those things down. And then the flip side of that, I think sometimes it's helpful to find the words of others, not necessarily people who have lived through precisely what you're living through. But, you know, when I was talking about Dinah Smith's poetry earlier, I think, you know, turning to the words of somebody who finds a way to hold grief and joy at once, or hope and despair at once, I think that can feel like a kind of consolation in difficult times. It's not false. It's not cheap. It's not fake. It owns everything that's hard and find some beauty anyway.
Owns the moment. Leslie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure to talk to you and to be back on the show. I really appreciate the invitation.
Author Leslie Jamison, her most recent book is Make It Scream, Make It Burn. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.